To our leasing roundtable today, we'd like to thank those who are participating with us and have volunteered to help our board as well as the ISB understand some of the comments that you raised in your comment letters. As you know, this is one of several roundtables that we're hosting. We have one this afternoon as well as two roundtables that we'll be holding on the West Coast in a few weeks' time, one of which will be focusing on non-public entities. So today we plan to cover several aspects of the leasing model. Hopefully you've had a chance to look at the material that we sent out in advance. We plan to discuss the model itself, the line, the differences between lessor and lessee, measurement including lease term and variable lease payments, the definition of course, and then any other areas that folks would like to comment on, including transition and disclosure and other simplification and suggestions you may have. We will also allow time at the end for some closing remarks. But before we get started, I just wanted to mention that we do have a new audio system. This webcast will be broadcast by audio only, not video, but audio across the web. And we do have a new audio system which has these fancy new microphones that you have to press on and off. So if the green light's lit, it's on. If it's not, it's not on. And if you can hear yourself in the PA system, that means you're close enough that people across the web can hear you clearly. So before we get started, I wondered if we could just go around the room and introduce ourselves. Danielle, would you like to start?
Sure. Good morning. Danielle Zayer, FASB staff.
Katrina Buchanan, IASB staff.
Matt Esposito, FASB staff.
Sarah Geisman, IASB staff.
Good morning, Anna Heining, IASB staff.
Good morning, John Bishop, PricewaterhouseCoopers.
Joe Nyström, IASB board member.
I'm Tom James with the Truck Renting and Leasing Association.
Daryl Buck, FASB.
John Bober, GE, representing FEI.
Jim Croker, FASB.
Stacy Tedeschi, Los Gals Associates.
Remember to turn your mics on.
There we go. Go ahead.
Mark Sittlinger, Ally Financial.
Monty Garrett, Verizon.
Russ Golden, FASB.
John Hepp, Grant Thornton.
Phil Pacino, representing the Mass Society of CPAs.
Larry Smith, FASB.
Jennifer Mickey-Gerard, SEC staff.
George Youngman, the National Association of Real Estate Investment Trusts.
Mark Siegel, FASB.
Brian S. Worthy, Penske Truck Leasing.
There it is. Jim Straczewski, LaSalle Investment Management. I'm representing Real Estate Information Standards.
Steve Winnick, FASB staff.
Sydney Traub, FASB staff.
Scott Muir, FASB staff.
And Lisa Muehlbauer, FASB staff.
So that was a good test. You have to remember to turn it on and turn it off when you're done. You know, as we normally do in these sessions, to the extent that you'd like to get in and speak, if you could just turn your placard up on its side, we'll try to log it in the order that they were turned up. And then if somebody's speaking and you feel very, very passionately about what they have to say and you want to respond to it, you know, the double hand always works really well. So with that, we're planning to run till noon today. We will have a break around 10:45, depending on where we cut off that last topic before the break. And with that, I guess I'll turn it over to Danielle to tee up topic one.
Okay, great. Thank you. Hopefully you've had a chance to take a look at the agenda. We will try to get through all the items. So I would say what we're going to start with is talking about the lessee model. So let's try to keep our conversation maybe on the lessee model, and we'll get to the other areas as we get through the morning. So as you know, the exposure draft proposes that all entities would recognize assets and liabilities arising from a lease. Different from the 2010 exposure draft, the 2013 exposure draft proposes everyone will have assets and liabilities, but the pattern in the income statement would be different depending whether you're a type A or a type B lease. And for practical purposes, that assessment would depend on the nature of the underlying asset. The principal is more dependent on whether the lessee is expected to consume more than an insignificant portion of the economic benefits embedded in the underlying asset. So I think what we'd like to do is talk about the lessee model, talk about the income statement and the balance sheet for all lessees, and where that line is drawn, and your thoughts on that when you're thinking about the accounting for lessees. So I'd like to turn it over to the group to hear your thoughts.
So in the materials, it's the questions that we have teed up for the lessee are questions 1, 2, and 4, and lessor question 3. So who would like to kick us off? I'll call on you. John?
Nope. Well, somebody had to. Yes. We don't think that all leases are economically the same, that there is a distinction between some leases that act more in the nature of a service. I think you can see it with ultra-short-term leases that most people would not consider that to be a financing arrangement or a sale. We do have the practical expedient in the original documents of 1 year or less that would be exempted from the model, but we saw that as not as an indication maybe that those leases were different, that they weren't transferring the same level of control of the underlying asset. So we do see that some leases are very similar to a sale, and some are very similar to the provision of a service. So we do think that a dual leasing model, despite the complexity, may be necessary just in order to reflect the different economics that you have in different types of transactions that all fall under the umbrella of a lease.
John Bishop?
Well, certainly agree that not all leases are the same, and some have elements of a service or executory arrangement, and some are more similar to finance purchases of property. So given that reality, it's hard to see how a standard that doesn't accommodate those two commercial arrangements would be useful. So a two-model system seems to be something that would be inevitable. There are certain aspects of the current proposal that PwC struggles with. One is the basis for determining which side of the line you fall on. With all its warts that we allegedly have today in our model, at least the model is designed to be neutral and not focused on property type, but focused on transaction type. We struggle with the part of the proposal that focuses on the type of property you have, and that'll drive the nature of the accounting. So, yes, we're behind a two-model system, but the current approach to distinguishing between the two models we're struggling with.
And what would be your suggestion for changing that?
At the risk of attracting negative attention, our proposal is to come up with a model that's not too dissimilar from the IAS 17 approach to distinguishing between what John mentioned is more like a service arrangement from those that are finance purchases. We know the negative of that is that we're sticking with the same old, but we think that does a reasonable job in distinguishing between the two types.
Just to be clear, when you guys are saying distinguishing between, are you saying distinguishing between on the balance sheet and income statement or just on the income statement?
Well, right now we're only proposing two models for the income statement for the most part, so it'll be the income statement.
Larry's got the double fist.
So when you say move towards IAS 17, is that what you really mean, or are you saying as applied by people looking towards FAS 13 as a guide to apply some of the principles?
That's a fair question, Larry. Look, we have a lot of lines in U.S. GAAP where the standard itself doesn't create, you know, bright lines, if you will, or practice guidelines. But nevertheless, practice evolves in a certain way. The big one we have is in, you know, hedge accounting. The 80 to 120 rule is not, it doesn't reside anywhere in the actual standard or the codification, but yet practice has drawn that line. So would I be surprised if the IAS 17 model in the U.S. started to evolve to the 75% test and the 90% payout test? No, I wouldn't.
But you think practice could handle it?
I think practice can handle it.
Okay, Mark is next.
Well, as the two Johns indicated, we have two models today for capital versus operating leases, so I think a two-model approach is appropriate. One of the things and the thoughts that we had as we were putting together our comment letter is just where that line gets drawn. I know that for Type A leases, I think the expectation is that the transaction is in many ways a financing. We struggle with considering a lot of those transactions financing when you're getting only limited ability to have the true access and rights and responsibilities of ownership. You never get title. It doesn't pass over. I know at some point you do have to draw a line, as in with the 80% on the minimum lease payments. Maybe 80% is too far. Maybe bring it down to 50% or something when you go to financing. But we would be supportive of a model that went more to or was more in line with the current rules, but, you know, maybe softened it a little bit to something like that 50% threshold as opposed to the 80% threshold on the lease payments.
Jim?
Just to follow up, Mark, I just wanted to test. You're saying certain leases having elements of financing. Would you propose, though, for the non-financing type leases, those would still go on balance sheet? It would just, like Russ asked earlier, just income statement?
Yeah. No, absolutely. I think it's you know, when you think about why this project originally started, it started because from a lessee perspective, there's a concern that there's an unrecorded liability. I think it's hard to argue that point. I think there is an unrecorded liability. I think that liability should be on the balance sheet somewhere.
Tom?
I have to make sure my microphone is working here. TRALA, Truck Renting and Leasing Association, also, you know, believes there's two kind of leases, and I just wanted to take a second. I don't know what other equipment leases are like, but with a truck lease, it's average 3 to 4 year, maybe a 5 year term, and the vast majority of our leases are full service leases, which you're not just leasing the asset, but you're leasing the maintenance and repair of that asset, replacement vehicles, ensuring that the lessee gets, you know, the same level of consumption of the economic benefit through the right to use that asset throughout the term. So I think we're the ultimate definition of an operating lease, and you know, we certainly realize that some leases are indeed capital leases and they are indeed different alternative forms of financing. But we think that there's still a place for the operating lease. We think that increased disclosure through footnotes is perhaps as effective as putting that on the balance sheet. And I wanted to introduce the type of leasing that we do, which I think is different than a lot of the leasing that goes on around the table here. In some cases, the service component of a full service truck lease can be up to 40% of the payment for the right to use that asset, and that changes over time because as the asset gets older, it needs more and more service. So by the end of the term of the lease, the service component could be up to 60% of the cost of the lease payment is wrapped up in the service rather than in the right to use that asset.
Daryl, do you have a follow up?
Yes. So when you say that you think that those truck leases are sort of the typical operating type lease, when you say that, do you mean that you think therefore they don't meet the definition of a liability and shouldn't be on the balance sheet because of that? Or do you say that maybe they do meet the definition of a liability, but to reflect economically what's going on with the transaction, it should not be put on the balance sheet. It should be treated more like a service contract.
It should be treated more, I believe it should be treated more like a service or an executory contract, because the risks of ownership continue to be borne by the lessor, and those risks include the risk of the residual value. There's no guarantee to the lessor what that residual value will be. And particularly with trucks, there are forces that affect that residual value beyond the contract, forces like the demand for capacity, which is driven by general economics or government mandating emissions. A lot of our trucks, through changes in federal emission standards, are no longer viable for use on the road by the time their lease is done, because states or the federal government have adopted different equipment mandates. So as far as liability goes, most of that liability is still, you know, resting with the owner. As far as obligation to pay to make the payments, that lies with the lessee.
So you're really saying that the sort of risk and reward model of FAS 13, you think, appropriately reflects the transaction that's going on versus what we've sort of gone to as a more control-based model, and despite the fact that the lessee might have control of the underlying, you don't think that should change the way that it's accounted for?
No, I think the risk and reward tests work very well for our business models.
Philip?
There we go. Thank you. I guess I'm in a little bit different category. I'm the chairman of the Accounting and Auditing Committee of the Mass Society of CPAs, and basically the committee is made up of small practitioners who basically service small and medium entities. So I guess I'm representing the smaller companies. Basically, I agree with the two Johns that there should be dual models. I do think that there should be some sort of risk and reward test, as opposed to the control test that's been in the standard. I have the practitioners that I deal with and the small clients that I deal with have a concern about the cost versus the benefit of this standard. There'd be a huge cost for them to implement this, even at the smallest level, and they don't really see a lot of benefit. The small client, usually the only person they're reporting to is the bank. That statement goes to the bank. Even with the VIEs, we would ask the bank if they would accept a gap departure. Many bankers did. It seems crazy to have to go to my client and recommend that they violate a standard, but that's potentially what could happen. We don't see the benefit. We also feel there'd be a lot of subjective judgment that would come into play with greater than consumption. That's why we would like to see the risk and reward standards potentially be put in place, or some sort of we actually were talking about some sort of rules-based, but I know we're supposed to talk about rules-based, we're supposed to talk about principles-based, but we'd like to see the risk and reward standards come into play, some sort of standards come into place, because that would really be what benefits with the small and medium-sized client. The other thing that we will have is if the standard goes through as is, you're going to see more of the smaller clients migrate to either other types of gap statements, non-gap statements, particularly the ones the AICPA has put out, FRF. You'll see them potentially go to that or to go to basically non-gap statements.
John?
Thank you. You know, I think what we're going through here right now is asking ourselves a fundamental question. Is this project about the underlying asset, or is it about the contract? Because a lot of an IAS 17-based approach is really trying to get at the nature of what is the transaction with the underlying asset. You know, right now we've got a proposal that determines scope based on the underlying, recognizes based on the contract, allocates expense based on the underlying, and then remeasures based on the contract. So I think that as we approach the leasing standard, we need to think, what is it that we're really trying to account for? And I think if we're looking at the asset, I think IAS 17 is probably a good way of looking at it. I think also another alternative would be to spend more time on control, because I think the control notion we have here is kind of control light. But then the other alternative is to focus on the contract, and what you have there is a contract that contains an embedded asset component and an embedded liability component, and trying to get at what is the most cost-effective way of dealing with that. We think that a display-based model which simply recognized the asset and liability would be a very efficient way of getting at that, and then letting the P&L flow through as rent. But that's kind of where we're coming from and why we got to where we are. But there is this fundamental divide. It's like, is the standard about the asset or the contract?
Brian?
Penske agrees that not all leases are the same. We don't agree with using the underlying asset as a basis for that. We don't think that property and equipment should be held to different standards. We also don't agree that that line should be more than insignificant consumption. We prefer the current classifications for operating capital leases, which also align closely with the legal and tax systems today. And we'd also be opposed generally to any of today's operating leases having income statement recognition with interest and amortization.
So when you say that you prefer today, would you still have on-balance sheet treatment for both?
We're not opposed to on-balance sheet treatment, but we think, especially Penske is a full-service operating lessor, we think that's similar to service contracts. So, I mean, I would say if a service contract would be a liability, then I'd say our leases would be a liability as well. Customers.
Bill?
I do think that there are two classifications. I think the IAS 17 is...
Bill, can you speak into the mic?
I was saying I do think there are two types of leases. I think that the current gap, probably more IAS 17 than FAS 13 because it gets more to the substance of the transaction, is the best way to come up with a dividing line, and the asset shouldn't matter. And the contract, looking at the contract, you know, we say we want to account for the rights and obligations, but some contracts transfer ownership rights. Others transfer merely the right of use. And the board could have chosen to scope those out that transfer ownership. But since they didn't, I think they still have to look at the rights and obligations first, determine which leases transfer ownership and which don't, and then account for them differently. And I don't argue that an executory contract in a going concern creates a liability because of the hell or high water clause that's in most leases, except what kind of a liability is it and what kind of an asset is it? And I think you have to look at the substance. And in the U.S., we have a UCC set of UCC rules as well as tax rules that are pretty much in line with the current risks and rewards tests in accounting, and so I think that lenders and users of financial statements need to understand the nature of the asset. I'm not saying account for leases assuming a bankruptcy, but I'm saying call the executory contract asset maybe a contract asset, or maybe an intangible asset. And the liability is not debt in bankruptcy, so call it an executory contract liability, because the lenders to the companies that do most equipment leasing, that's small and medium-sized enterprises and non-investment-grade companies, need that information. It's very basic. And I don't think we should come up with some kind of an accounting construct that doesn't give the people who lend to companies the information they need. It's what the IAC committee has said, that they really need to know what the nature of the liabilities are. It's just kind of basic, where the rubber meets the road, accounting information that people who lend the next dollar to a small, medium-sized entity and non-investment-grade company who don't have access to public markets in general, they just need that information broken down on a risk and rewards basis, even though both types of leases are on balance sheet.
Monty?
Yes, it
At Verizon, we don't have an issue with putting all the leases on the balance sheet. We think most of the parties that look at our financials already put on an estimate for operating leases and don't have a problem with the two types of leases. The only thing we struggle with, in a good example for our industry, are tower leases or leases where there are multiple assets in play, and trying to identify which bucket that particular lease goes in when you have both a property and an equipment arrangement in the same lease. So I think without some further clarification on how to categorize the leases, we would see, especially in the telecom industry, some variance between carriers with the same exact type of lease, but treating them versus type A or type B.
Okay. Other comments? More geared towards Leslie. George?
We just want to mention that land leases, as lessee, the proposed accounting seems to depart from the consumption principle. And we see where, you know, many real estate developers will have ground leases, land-only leases from primarily cities and other government agencies that own, like, downtown land or land around the airport, et cetera. And I know the boards dealt with land leases maybe a few years ago, but I don't think you had the boards had focused on or concluded with respect to the consumption principle. And when I look up, when I think about a land lease, I don't know what we're consuming. So I think that's probably a type B lease that's going to wind up under this proposal as type A lease, because the present value of the lease payments for 50 years is probably going to be greater than the value of the land at the commencement date of the lease. So I think we see that as an issue, and I guess I'd summarize it by saying an inconsistency between the inconsistency with the consumption principle. The other thing I'd like to mention is the proposal suggests that, well, more than suggests, indicates that if you have a building and land lease, that you use the building as the indicator of the economic life. And some of our members really kind of jumped on that one and said, well, wait a minute. If we enter into a lease for the future development and there's some building on that land that is really not the ultimate property to be leased out, it doesn't seem right that we would automatically use the building to determine the remaining economic life of that package, building and land. And we wondered why we would have that requirement when the paragraph just before it talks about how to identify the primary asset. And that would be fine to just eliminate that specific requirement for a land building lease.
Did you want to Brian? Oh, sorry, Mark.
George, on that front, others have suggested moving toward a IAS 17 line. Would that work for you? I'm not sure that it would on the land lease situation.
I have to admit I'm not that familiar with IAS 17. How would that work? I mean,
well, that gets to Larry's question earlier. If it works similarly to FAS 13, assume that it works similarly to FAS 13, present value of the minimum lease payments equal to 90% of the fair value?
Sue.
Oh, John.
Just to make sure the group's on the same page. The way FAS 13 works today is land leases are treated differently. So land leases do not get capitalized under the 75% test nor the 90% test. They'll only get capitalized under the transfer title test or the option.
Okay. Right.
So there is an acknowledgement that land leases are different, and most of the time the economics of a land lease are you're just paying a return on the investment. There's no investment recovery in a land lease. Yeah.
And maybe I'll just add from an IS-17 perspective that, of course, the proposals around classification for property do pick up the words that are identical to what's in IS-17. However, IS-17 is a few more words around land leases today that implies, you know, you sort of always consider, you almost always sort of presume the life of the land to be indefinite, so there probably is some sort of looser wording in IAS-17.
So if you're suggesting that we move toward an IAS-17, if people are suggesting moving toward an IAS-17, would you think that we need to perpetuate that exception for land leases? Yes.
Brian?
Just one last thing on lessees. Echoing Philip's remarks, I think Penske also speaks for a lot of small entities. The vast majority of our lease customers are small, non-public entities, I think with most of them a fleet size of less than 10 vehicles. So we're overly concerned with the complexity and the cost to implement for those lessees. We think they most of them have gap financial statements just to maintain compliance with their credit agreements, and we envision them either requiring a lot more information or possibly even Penske providing the accounting for them. We have concerns they'd be able to do that on their own. Or else we think they'd modify their credit agreements to be based on frozen gap or else have gap departures as well. So just like that, I could those concerns for our small customers.
Russ?
So what I hear around the table, and I wanted to confirm this and then test something, is I hear most of you saying you're generally okay with it being on the balance sheet, but with respect to the income statement, it should be a split, and the split should be really focus hard on IS-17. But I pause because I have the car lessor, I have other equipment lessors that are telling me something different than the trucking lessors. What I hear the car lessors and the other equipment lessors saying, it's okay to be in the balance sheet. But the trucking lessors seem to be saying, no, pause because of the significant service component. So the reason I want to test that is that because you believe that because of the significant service component, it takes the entire thing to an executory contract? Or do you believe it should be split? And then after that, I'd like to ask the real estate lessors, do you share the same view that there should be a split, or if there's a significant service component within real estate, it should also be off balance sheet? Because I think that is the debate that I hear around the table.
Bill, did you want to respond?
No, I think I should give my time up because
okay.
Full service leases that's created by the fact that the problem with a full service lease where both components are executory under the old rules, of course, both are off balance sheet, no issue. Now that we're going to capitalize the lease portion, and we're going to force lessees to find an observable market rate for either the service contract or the lease, makes it extremely difficult because each truck is configured differently with different equipment on it, and so the service contract and the lease portion varies so significantly that I think it would be very hard to find an observable pricing of a contract. So I think you need to simplify that. You need to use estimates. I think would solve some of that problem, although I don't really want to speak for Tralla or Penske.
Well, we certainly support that idea of using estimates, and as I mentioned earlier, even the service component and the asset component of the lease changes over the term of the lease. Trucks start needing more and more repairs. I think maybe one difference between the truck and the auto lessors with regard to our service components is a lot of our trucks are also used in interstate commerce. So in addition to just the service on the truck, that executory part of the contract includes reciprocal agreements with maintenance facilities all across the nation. So that just helps clarify, I think, a little difference between between truck and car.
And then the real estate. Do you think that it is feasible to estimate the service versus the use component? And what would be an easier? Do you think the way we described it was sufficient, or do you think there would be an easier way to separate?
This has become a big issue in the industry. I think most of us are confused about what services means. most real estate leases include some reimbursement of the landlord's costs to maintain the landlord's property, not the tenant's property. We're not servicing the tenant. The contract is not servicing the underlying asset, i.e. the tenant space. You said service, so I'm assuming that this is what you're talking about. Where the tenant reimburses the landlord for the landlord's cost of maintaining the landlord's property, the common areas, the parking, the landscaping, that kind of thing. We don't see that as a service to the tenant. We think that that revenue is simply a part of the lessee's occupancy cost. And as a matter of fact, the industry really has moved to gross leases to some extent, 25%, call it, because the landlord, the lessee, the analysts, the investors are looking at total occupancy cost. I'd say that started 15 years ago. You know, can the tenant pay us 14% of sales in a retail center, 16% of sales? Don't really care much how the reimbursements and what some might call the rent to occupy the space. Not concerned too much with that breakdown. I think we concluded that the best way to account for that total occupancy cost, that revenue from the total occupancy cost, would be to call it all lease income and then disclose in the note the amount of gross lease, net lease, what the reimbursables are, and through disclosure really provide an understanding of that lease income stream.
Chime in as well from a lessor perspective. I would echo George's comments. I would also say there are some service components to leases. Those are typically handled outside. If you have tenant services of certain kinds, those are usually treated differently on the income statement and would rarely hit the balance sheet. But they are there if required. I would say on the variable component, the escalation component, though, I would echo what George said.
George?
Thanks, Jim. there are service agreements. I'm cleaning the tenant space. It's outside the lease. The lease arrangement that I talked about. I'm providing valet service for some restaurant that has an outside entrance. They're all services. So I agree that there could be services, but not the reimbursements for the landlord's cost of maintaining the common areas and the landlord's property.
John? Oh, Daryl, sorry, double hand.
I wanted to follow up just a little bit more on this service inclusion with the lease component to touch more on where I think Russ might have been going with his question. If we have two identical lease agreements for pieces of equipment, and one of them has a significant service component and the other one doesn't. Okay, I can see on the one that has the significant service component bifurcating that into its two pieces and putting the lease part on the balance sheet. I think that's what we've proposed, right? I can also sort of see another alternative that would say, well, if you can't reasonably break those out, then just consider it all to be lease and put it all on the balance sheet.
Where I'm struggling with is the argument that would say just because you have a significant service component, then that means nothing in that agreement should go on the balance sheet. Can somebody help me with that argument?
Are you asking from a real estate or any perspective?
I said equipment, but it could be anything.
I can respond from a truck equipment perspective. We're not saying that just because it has a service component that it should not be recognized as a lease at all. Our main concern is Penske does not offer standalone leases. All of our lease products are full-service leases. We do, however, offer a separate contract maintenance for customers that own their own equipment. So what we could provide as an observable standalone price to lessees is only the maintenance component. Using that residual method, then, you're actually going to allocate less to the lease component than you would if you would allow customers to use more judgment in estimating and bifurcating those two costs. So that's our concern, is that the requirement for observable standalone values for our customers.
Sean?
You know, apropos of the question here, I think, you know, right now we kind of are thinking of this where we have a leased asset and then services thrown on top of that contract. In the proposals, if you have a service contract, you then drill down and say, do I have a embedded lease within that arrangement, and let me do lease accounting for that embedded asset. One of the differences which could exist is that, you know, when you have a lease with services, you may have a hell or high water obligation on it. But if you have a service arrangement, there could be conditionality around the payments that the recipient of the service has back to the person who's providing the service. It's almost, to put it into the new revenue recognition speak, is there a distinct performance obligation in there? Yes, no, maybe. And I think one of the questions we haven't really looked at in the project is what impact conditionality of payment has on the determinations we're making. I think I hear from the trucking people that since all they're providing is a service arrangement that contains an embedded lease, there is a possibility that there is a conditionality around they're being paid about whether or not they do the other things. Whether that distinction matters in the project is something for you all to consider, but it may be a distinction.
Art?
Yes, these comments are with respect to the lessee. And City does believe that there are two types of leases.
Speak into the mic, sorry.
Sorry, City does believe that there are two types of leases and that they both belong on the balance sheet. I think the comments that we've heard throughout the morning are indicative of the complexity of the proposal. And City has suggested that we find some way of simplifying the proposal. So that's all I'll add.
John?
Going back a little bit to Russ's original point, and I've heard several of the board members refer to the issue of would you have different balance sheet treatment for different types of leases. The elephant in the room in many cases in this project is accounting for enforceable obligations, whether they're a lease or a service. And how do we incorporate the accounting for those into double-entry bookkeeping? Double-entry bookkeeping isn't really designed for doing that. If you discount these enforceable obligations, you're treating them as if they're a financing and as if the asset is a tangible asset. The revenue recognition took a different approach to look at these as being contract assets and performance obligations. And we think that for many of lease type arrangements, that's probably a better description of the assets and liabilities that arise from the arrangement. If there's a financing element, I think you would have a different type of balance sheet treatment for and different asset for what you would be putting in the balance sheet. I think you would look to the underlying asset. If you have an arrangement that's more in the nature of a service, an executory arrangement as it were, I think you would have contract assets and enforceable obligations under contracts that would be recorded. It's not really debt, as Bill was saying earlier. It's a different type of arrangement. And the question remains, how do we account for that type of arrangement? the current project is by separating out the lease element from the non-lease elements and saying we're only looking at the enforceable obligations that relate to the lease, that creates complexity. And I've seen this in many of the comment letters. What is a lease and what is not a lease becomes very important because we've got a bright line there. If we determine that it's a lease, it all goes on the balance sheet. If it's not a lease, none of it goes in the balance sheet. Whereas I think a user of the financial statements is really wants to know what are the enforceable obligations or enforceable rights, in the case of a lessor, under the contract. So I think that you may have a difference between the balance sheet as well as the income statement for these executory-type leases. Do you want to put them on gross? We need a new accounting method for how we're going to do that. And maybe we would put the service elements on too. We don't really need to go through the exercise of separating out service elements from the right of use asset when the information that the user of the financial statement wants is the whole package. We would be going through a lot of work in the exercise to produce information that's less relevant than we would have had we not done the exercise. So I think this is, again, the major issue. How do we account for these enforceable obligations that don't transfer control of the underlying asset, but that do exist within a contract?
Daryl?
John, I'm sure you're aware, I think we explained in the basis that the way we're distinguishing the lease contracts from other types of executory contracts is that, you know, the lease involves the delivery of control of the underlying. Do you think that that's an appropriate distinction to make for why the lease element would be shown on the balance sheet and the service element wouldn't?
Short answer is no. That's the fundamental principle of the project, that I'm going to distinguish some executory contracts because there's an underlying tangible asset, specific asset that we have the right to control the use of, involved. And I don't know if that principle produces relevant financial information.
Jim?
So if I took that a little bit further, perhaps what I hear you saying is we drew the line incorrectly. We should be looking at the accounting for all executory contracts, and perhaps under that then a model that would bring all executory contracts on balance sheet?
Well, this is certainly going to be a precedent for that. There are some people that you can go back to AIMR, the CFA Institute reports more than a decade ago, maybe two, I'm dating myself again, but they called for that accounting a long time ago. Looking at the ISB's discussion paper on the conceptual framework, looking forward, they do talk about the issue of executory contracts, that they do create rights and obligations that meet the definition of an asset and liability. The question is, how do we account for those? Like I say, they don't fit well into double entry bookkeeping at the current time. We may have to have a new method rather than trying to account for them as if they're a part of a tangible asset and debt. Maybe we need a new accounting for these arrangements because the issue is not going to go away.
Russ?
I have a completely different topic. So if Bill and John want to get on this, I'll defer to them.
Bill?
First, I'd like to say that because the boards have decided that the lessor's executory obligations are complete by delivery of the asset, that's kind of a nice way of developing the basis for capitalizing leases. But the UCC doesn't say that executory obligations have completed. There's the quiet enjoyment and keeping the asset free of liens that, from a legal perspective, and I think the bankruptcy laws have to be part of the definition of an asset, the U.S. laws say that, no, execution hasn't been completed. And now to talk about what John is bringing up, as far back as 2008, the ELFA suggested a method, and John has started to talk about it a bit, where maybe the problem is disclosure isn't good enough, but the obligations and assets should be on the balance sheet. So what we've suggested is, and it's what John is saying, maybe we don't need double entry bookkeeping for this. Maybe we just need to put the value of the assets and liabilities associated with executory contracts on the balance sheet each month and then take them off each month, replace them the next month with the new value, keep the P&L the same, and I think we've accomplished putting those important liabilities, and as I said, for a going concern, it's a liability, but it's not in bankruptcy. But I think if it's important to get that on the balance sheet, and we're struggling with the traditional way of looking at, well, if I have an asset, I got to amortize it. If I have a liability, I have to account that's PV'd, I have to account for it on the interest method. Well, maybe not. If maybe we should just say we're accounting for the value of the contract, and the value of the contract, I submit, except for impairment, is the same as time goes by. And we can still account for impairment, and we can still account for initial direct costs as a sub-account to the ROU asset. And I think that would answer it. And the ELFA in their comment letters, my comment letter, and as far back as 2008, we've been recommending that kind of accounting.
John?
Thank you. I think we're having a problem with the accounting for leases because it is a special form of executory contract. And I think as we go and try and produce a good model, I think there's several ways of looking at it. One is, you can always go back to the SEC study and say, well, what are the faults with the current system? It's all or nothing, and it's lacking transparency. So if we focus on trying to fix those deficiencies, but at the same time developing a model that best mirrors the economics, provides users which have very diverse needs the information that they need, or alternatively at least something that they can deal with very simply, is perhaps the best way of going forward with this project. I mean, we've suggested a contract-based approach because it eliminates some of the issues that go with having to look at each of the individual assets. And under that contract-based approach, you just PV the rents, recognize the asset, recognize the liability, and let rent fall through the P&L in each period. I think one of the questions that I often hear raised in these forums is, does a lease have a financing component to it? I think that before you answer that question, you have to go back to what is a lease. A lease is a contract that has an asset and an obligation embedded in it. And we always have to ask ourselves, why are we breaking it apart here when what we ultimately have is this kind of special case of an executory contract? Yes, we can deal with some of these issues using an IAS 17 approach, but it may be cleaner to adopt a contract-based display approach because, one, gets rid of the all-or-nothing problem and also, you know, improves transparency.
Katrina, did you want to jump in?
I suppose I just wanted to I think you're all aware, but just amongst the conversation, clarify obviously where the boards are so far in the project and why they have proposed, you know, that leases do go on the balance and obviously service components, if they exist within one contract, don't. And it's obviously because I hear the conversation about clearly that some of you view leases as being a special form of executory contract. Obviously, to this point, the boards have concluded that leases are not executory contracts, that there has been performance, and therefore that a lessee has received an asset. It's received, you know, the right to use an asset, and it also has a liability. So that's obviously, you know, the boards haven't viewed it as an executory contract or a special form. They viewed it as something different, which is why it made sense to them that leases should be treated differently, you know, from other service components. And I suppose at least so far in various pieces of outreach that we've done with investors and analysts, at least the majority of investors and analysts also seem to say to us that they view leases as creating debt-like liabilities. Just wanted to...
John?
I think one of the questions... Which John, sorry.
Oh, sorry, John Bishop.
Sorry, John. Would you like to speak? I'll just on the overall comments about the original conclusions that leases are not executory contracts, but there's an actual upfront performance, and then the rest of the performance is unilateral over its time. That debate has been, I've been in the leasing business for a long time, and that debate has been very spirited on both sides, and I think both sides have some very, very strong arguments, as Bill indicated. And if you go back to the original exposure draft, personally, I was willing to accept the judgment and the conclusion that it's not an executory contract because you followed that through in a theoretically very pure way that, okay, it's not an executory contract, it's a finance purchase, and the day two accounting followed through on that theory. Now we've kind of migrated and morphed, and for the income statement, we've somehow acknowledged that they're not all the same. There is an executory service kind of lease, and then there's an actual finance purchase. And now we've tried to reconcile what we want on the balance sheet with a completely different income statement model. And as John pointed out, our double entry system is not accommodating that. We've indicated a lot of practical concerns here, but there are some real theoretical concerns, right? The amortization or the depreciation of the Type B leased asset is an annuity type depreciation model. That's an approach that we've just not accepted in U.S. GAAP for as long as I've been in the business, and now we're going to, you know, accept an annuity type depreciation to accommodate a two-model system on the income statement with balance sheet recognition. We've got built-in asymmetry between lessor and lessee for Type B leases. You know, we're double counting asset economics. It's not clear to me how that's an improvement from where we are. You know, in the beginning of this project way back when, I kind of raised my hand and said, you know, if you put a lot of leasing experts in the room and focused on remediating some of the abusive elements of FAS 13, I think we could come up with a pretty good solution. And that didn't get a lot of traction because there are leases that are legitimate service arrangements. Then the need to go through the effort to put them on the balance sheet is not entirely clear. But I have been in the business a long time. There are leases at the highly structured end of the continuum that really are finance purchases. And there are ways to fix that. But, you know, it's just not clear to me that where we are in this proposal is meeting that objective.
Russ?
So two of you raised substantial cost and complexity to non-public. I think it was Brian and Phil. Does the potential – is that complexity around the interest and amortization approach, or is it around putting on the balance sheet with both approaches? I'm trying to get at is what is the specific thing you would recommend to the board to change so you don't make the comment that it increases cost and complexity?
I'll go first. The concern that the accounting audit committee has is, first off, the clients are going to have to figure out how to do this. Many clients that we have, that the committee has, don't have staff that can put this together. They're going to have to figure out how to do this. There's going to be a lot of training. There's going to be a lot of training to the practitioners. In addition to, you know, serving as the chairman, I'm a peer reviewer. You'd be amazed how un-up-to-date many practitioners are in terms of the standards. And basically what I see is coming to the measurement and what to record on the balance sheet and how to make the entries and what to do going forward on the P&L. It's actually both. The cost would be concerned at how to apply this, how to put it together, the education factor to both to the client and the practitioners, and going forward, what should be done, what the double entry system should be.
But how would you improve, what suggestions would you make so that we might alleviate some of the cost and complexity?
One of the things that it's more measurement. The committee is very strong about having some sort of de minimis number. And what we mean by de minimis numbers is some sort of materiality limit. That leases that are that basically value out less than some number. I read somebody had a comment letter of $250,000. Was one of the comment letters I read. With that actually being in place, That would maybe drop out a lot of the, once you do the original calculation, then it would drop out what the accounting needs to be. Also, the committee members suggested making, instead of the 12 months, in terms of defining short lease, define it as 24. I've also read another comment letter that said it talked about 36 months. I don't think we'd have objection to that one either in terms of that. So, I mean, those are the comments that I see. And, you know, quite truthfully, if the boards go forward with this, which is potentially could happen, you know, I think you need to, as some of the people talked up here about the risk and rewards method, as opposed to substantially consumed, because that leaves a lot of subjective judgment. And, you know, we need to maybe a risk and rewards similar to what we now have in the financing leases versus the operating leases. I think those would be some of the issues that potentially could help, you know, small practitioners and small clients.
But one, just if the end result was take what is the minimum lease payments today and put it on the balance sheet, I still hear you saying that's too hard for them to implement. That is no different than what you do today. So is that what you're saying? And if so, why is that so hard to do?
Well, it's hard to do at this point because you've got to do the calculations. Just not, you know, saying, oh, no, my payments are going to be $200,000 over the next few years, and that's what's going to be, you know, on the balance sheet, and then I'm going to straight line that over a period of time. It's much more than that. The proposal goes much more than that. You've heard the discussion about all the executory costs here. There's a whole, you know, what defining a lease, the executory costs, and so forth. I mean, the complexity of the issue goes just beyond putting the minimum value on.
Yeah, but I mean, Russ's point is, if we stick with what we have today in terms of you know, sticking with 17 or 13 even, in terms of determining what type of lease you have, whether you have a finance lease or whether you have an operating lease, but all we're going to do is put it on the balance sheet. Surely you're not saying that people can't do a present value analysis to come up with the dollar amount to put on the balance sheet.
That is correct. I'm not saying they can't do that. I'm not saying they can't do that. And what I'm saying is that, you know, it's going to be continuing accounting going forward, and the cost of getting all that information together and coming up with that calculation is going to be on us.
To make the commitment footnote anyway. To do the five-year calculation, to do the five-year the presentation and the footnotes, you need that information.
I thought where you were going with the complexity was with Type B leases and the mechanics of assembling the pieces necessary to get to the straight line P&L effect.
Yes, that too.
What I'm trying to figure out by answering the questions is the concern really about cost, and is there an easier way to do it, or is the concern about the non-public constituents that you represent just don't think it's relevant to put it on the balance sheet?
Well, that too. I mean, the non-public companies that I represent see no value of this going on the balance sheet. As a matter of fact, some of them said probably what would have to be done is people would have to unwind them to figure out what the liabilities are and do the analysis at this point. They don't see the value of going through and doing this exercise, spending the money, putting all the information together, doing the calculations, figuring out what to do, and then they don't see what value this would be in terms of what's actually on the balance sheet or in the P&L. It would not help them either evaluate their companies or for outsiders to evaluate their companies.
Brian?
Just to talk to our cost and complexity concerns for our customers, we certainly think they could capitalize at least one time. Our major concern is, again, estimating the service or the lease and the non-lease components. We'd like to see more judgment other than having to get separate RFPs from different vendors for the pure lease cost. We think that would ease transition. Also, another concern is the constant reassessment tied to CPI. We think that would be difficult to monitor, especially once you have more than 10 leases, I'd say, in total, and monitoring every time one of those leases is tripped or on an annual basis. So the reassessment and the bifurcation are our main cost concerns.
Dad, in terms of the Type B leases, one of the concerns that we have is that potentially would fall out of the EBITDA calculations, EBITDA, because there would be interest and amortization that get added back. So that potentially would require that the transaction get unwound by whoever's doing the analysis to put those back together and determine what the proper EBITDA calculation is, or whether or not there would have to be a whole new definition of EBITDA that would have to come into place.
James?
I realize now I probably should have done my double hand raise. I didn't realize we were going to go this far with that, but I wanted to comment on something that Bill and John had mentioned about contractual-based revenue models. I represent an organization that has been following fair value of real estate practices for 20-plus years, and we have followed the model of contractual-based revenue while valuing that real estate. And the real estate as an investment really is the land, the building, and that those streams of revenues you receive from those underlying leases. That model has worked. Our investors understand it, predominantly because they understand what contractual revenue is. They can use contractual revenue because they understand it, and they can bring it into their own models and do their own analyses of those cash flow streams, build in whatever parameters they want to value. I think you'll find a lot of analysts do that at a very high level for real estate funds as it is. So, I mean, that model does work, but what it does, and I'm saying this because I'm offering almost a different approach, and I think that was what John was going for. It works for the investor. It works for the investment manager. It's a cash flow stream that people understand. Lenders get it. That's actually what they want. They want to see that cash flow, and they want to see it contractually based so they can do their own analysis. And I would say, since we went in another direction with the cost element too, the cost element for us comes from, I represent lessors, but I understand the lessee perspective. It's two different cost elements. As a lessor providing that asset, I get it. It's easier for me. As a lessee, that cost element's going to go up. They don't have the details of the variables you need to include in models, and especially not after, when you lease something, it's a point-in-time analysis. You're talking about an ongoing analysis, and that becomes more difficult. Constantly monitoring those calculations, the parameters, the variables of those calculations takes time, effort. And if you are a significant lessee of equipment, it takes a system, a computer system that needs monitoring implementation. And not a lot of those exist right now, at least not from the lessee of real estate perspective. The hands go up.
Tom?
Exciting. I'm sorry, I didn't follow the rules there. I represent an organization of lessors, and I notice there's a lot of lessors around the table, but our arguments are focusing on our concerns about the lessee. Now, there's a reason for that, and the reason is the cost and the complexity. We're concerned that our small business lessee customers are going to consider the lease option as a less viable option or a less attractive option. That's why we as lessors are sitting here talking about this, because we're concerned that this proposal is actually going to drive economic activity rather than reflect that activity from a reporting basis. So that's I just want to make that clear, that these costs and complexities are in our minds, not for our benefit, but for the viability of our product in the marketplace.
Mark?
Yeah, if I can just go a little further with what Tom is saying. We agree that fundamentally there's a difference between the decision to lease or to buy, and that I think is part of the struggle here, because what we're suggesting is all of these transactions, whether it's a lease or a buy, is the same, because we need the financing component, we need to build it in, and we need to think about it as if it's a financed purchase. And I don't think in many cases, if all I am as a lessee doing is renting the use of the equipment, I don't see the need to have that financing component, because I think that does add complexity. I think that will draw different conclusions from the lessee population in terms of what decision they make.
We've spent a lot of time talking about the lessee model And, Tom, you provided a good segue into getting some views about the lessor model.
Can I just say one thing?
Sure, Bill.
Because I do think I can give a simple example of what John Hepp and John Bober and I have been talking about. And to address the complexity of the small business person. Right now, in order to prepare financial statements, according to GAAP, everyone has to put their leases in some kind of an Excel spreadsheet with the future minimum lease payments. In the methodology that we're recommending, you can keep that Excel spreadsheet, put your incremental borrowing rate at the head of that column, and do a present value. And then to deal with something like CPI, which I do think when the CPI rate changes and my future rents change, I do now have an increased liability, I can just put the new rents in that same schedule. And so I can use that simple Excel spreadsheet to do all of the, in quotes, accounting, that all I need is a PV of the future rents, and I can change those future rents as the index or rates change. That's pretty simple. And I've been hired by a real estate systems company that has a system right now that manages real estate leases, but it's really just like tickler files and things like that. And he's changed that into an accounting system, and I think he's meeting with the staff to the owner of this business. The Type B accounting is incredibly complicated. And, like, he gives me examples. When CPI changes, it takes the Bureau of Labor Statistics 3 months to come up with the real CPI rate, but landlords start charging the estimated rate. And then 3 months later, they adjust it. And so that means two sets of tremendously complicated recalculations that if we use the simple Excel spreadsheet with this display model, that all goes away. And I think using IES 17 or FAS 13. I mean, we've been using those concepts and definitions for years. And I think change for the sake of change, like calling things the rate you charge the customer rather than the implicit rate, or going away from bargain purchase option or penalty for failure to renew to define when an option becomes an obligation. Why are we making those changes? Another thing is the R&R method. I also was asked to present at a lessor, for a lessor's systems company that's providing lessor accounting, they had me speak at their user group to talk about the accounting changes. And when I talked about the R&R method versus the DFL method, they're cosmetically the same. It's just cosmetically different. In substance, they're the same. And they told me there's millions of dollars worth of reprogramming to go to the R&R method. Why are we changing that? I think that's we have to start thinking about change for the sake of change. Just because we have a new board and we've decided to change some names and then people are confused about definitions, I think, you know, I think we should stick with the current rules as best as possible. There are some things that have been proposed in the ED that are vast improvements over what we have. But I think that the more we get away from what's been working since 1976 and what we're all used to, that and it's risks and rewards that in the U.S. model meshes with our tax and legal systems, I just think that we could do this much simpler. And a point that George made about having to go in and look at the different components, because we might have equipment, we might have land, we might have buildings. Why do we have a separate classification test for different types of assets when they're all either executory contracts or actually finance purchases? So I think if we go back, we can simplify an awful lot of things.
John, can you comment on lessor?
Oh,
since that's what we're trying to get some feedback on.
I was trying to echo something that Brian said, but I'll go into lessor.
If we could get some feedback on the lessor model, then we'd like to move to measurement.
Sure, I got it.
We spent quite a bit of time on, let's see.
Yeah.
Mark?
I can go ahead.
Okay.
You know, I think as we look at the lessor model that's being proposed, as Bill said, if you're dealing with something that's today a direct finance lease or a sales type lease, and tomorrow is going to be a Type A lease, there are changes that are being proposed which may not be that significant in total, but, however, are going to require a lot of systems reworks to do. In addition to that, there's always this question about the, I'll use the word, equipment leases, which were previously operating leases, which now have to be classified as type A. And that's a case of trying to put the square peg into the round hole, because those leases are, in many cases, not priced like finance leases. They're more akin to the real estate leases. So operationalizing a type A model for them will be difficult. And I don't know if it's useful to then construct an accounting regime that doesn't mirror the way people either look at the business from an external perspective or from an internal perspective. Therefore, from a lessor perspective, say that, look, based on the changes that are being proposed and based on, I think, what you're also probably hearing from investors is the world is better off if lessor accounting is not changed versus what we have today. The changes are broadly not meaningful enough to warrant the costs that go into the changes.
Mark?
Thank you. I guess starting off with lessor accounting, just a little bit about who we are. At Ally Financial, we are a financer or a lessor of automobile leases. We have over 700,000 leases as a lessor where we're leasing to the consumers an automobile. First, fundamentally, we don't believe that the economics of what we have on our balance sheet is necessarily broken. We look at today's model, we look at what's on our balance sheet, we look at the way we account for it, and we believe that it is a fair representation of the economics of the transaction. So I guess the fundamental question we ask, while we understand on the lessee side there is this unwritten liability that we talked about earlier, the question is here, do we really need to think about this from a symmetrical perspective? Do we really need, if the lessor has to record, or I'm sorry, the lessee has to record a payable, do I really need to break my asset between the residual and the receivable? We've broken many of the former concept statements. I know we've always talked about symmetry. We've talked about the matching principle. We've talked about a lot of things. But over the last several years, I think we've moved a little bit away from that in several standards. And I would just ask maybe the board to even tell me if why or if they feel that symmetry is necessary here.
Sorry, can I just ask a question of your business? Because I think you have about 700,000 car leases. Are they all operating leases today then, or any of those sales type? Or
currently today, they are all operating type leases. When we had our international operations, there were some that met the financing criteria. But domestically in the U.S., everything is an operating lease.
Thank you.
Monty?
Yeah, from the lessor standpoint, we can comply. We've got the means to comply with whatever the rules end up being. But the thing we care about the most is, do our investors and rating agencies understand what's going on with our business? So putting operating leases on the balance sheet is not a concern. Most of those people already make some estimate to put on in their analysis for us. I think, not to get into measurement, but the only thing we want to make sure of is that the investors can still understand a business and understand what type of obligations we're putting on the balance sheet and how we're classifying leases, that kind of thing. The way we do it today, calling things operating and capital, I think people understand that. Putting it on the balance sheet is probably a fair representation that there is an obligation there that we don't show today, but beyond that, I think all we're worried about is that the investor community and the rating agency community that looks at our numbers today are going to understand them less, not because something extra is on the balance sheet now, but trying to explain what type of lease we're calling type A, type B, when we have components of both in one single lease is our biggest concern.
Bill, you have something new to add?
Yeah, well, thanks for pushing my button for me. if I was in charge, I think that that lessor accounting works pretty darn well, and I think the biggest change I'd make is break symmetry and use business model as the method of accounting for lessors. I spent most of my career working for a financial institution, FAS 13 worked fine, except for those leases that were kind of on the borderline between maybe the PV was 88 or 87%. We'd buy residual insurance to change those into finance leases. Because as a financial institution, depreciation on an operating lease gets thrown into the operating efficiency ratio and is bad. And our decision to do a lease, actually we... But by law, we could only do a lease where the lessee had actually committed to do the lease with us. So they assigned us the purchase option. We bought the equipment. We leased it to them. We assessed what the likely residual value would be if we auctioned the equipment off and they returned it. We looked at it as a discrete financing transaction. And using business model would have avoided that extra cost of having to buy residual insurance. And then there are operating lessors who the operating lease accounting works just fine, and the current rules kind of give them that accounting, where rent is the income, depreciation and service costs are the expenses. And I think the investors looking at a financial lessor and an operating lessor would rather see business model accounting than strict symmetry. On the lessee side, lessees look at transactions completely differently. They look at them on a risk and rewards basis. They just look at the right of use. They don't care whether they're leasing that rail car from an operating lessor or a financial lessor. They just are looking for the right to use a rail car. And the other aspects of lessor accounting that are going to change here that I think shouldn't change are leveraged lease accounting, because I think that the previous board or the 1976 board, I think, did a pretty good job of coming up with what some people call elegant accounting that captures the risks and captures the tax benefits. As a result of leveraged lease accounting, other leases, by analogy, account for ITC as part of revenue. We're going to lose that. So we're going to lose leveraged lease accounting. We're going to lose the ability to count tax credits, which create revenue just as well as rents and residual. They're going to go on the tax line. And then the idea that only certain narrow types of residual guarantees aren't minimum lease payments to the lessor, I think that's a change that shouldn't change, because the lessor is going to, in a guaranteed residual, the lessor is going to get the cash either from sale of the equipment or sale of the equipment and the amount that the lessee is guaranteeing. So I'd make very minimal changes to what we have right now. The biggest one, I think, is the really only change would be to break symmetry and use business model.
Brian?
From the lessor perspective, again, I think Tom mentioned, from lessors, our main concern really is for lessee accounting. It's obviously a much larger population of lessees and lessors, so probably more significant impact there. But I think for lessors, it's going to be, for each lessor, more significant impact for them individually. For us to change to look like a financing company, it's going to require probably a complete revamp of our accounting system. It's just not how we view our business internally. So we'd certainly keep two sets of management reporting, where we keep the old GAAP for sure, and then only at the last time for external reporting make the adjustment to new GAAP, where we look like financing. But, I mean, specific to us as a full-service lessor as well, we have full residual risk on these assets. They're returned to us with significant useful life remaining. We either sell those to third parties or else we return them to our rental pool for subsequent usage. So, I mean, I think we are an operating lessor, and to change would not reflect the economics of how we view our business or how we how investors certainly view it. And I haven't seen a need for change. When I view the comment letters, I think there's a lot of questioning why change lessor accounting. So I'm not convinced there needs to be a change, or how this change is better, especially for operating lessors.
Russ?
I just want to follow up on business model and maybe widen it to John and Mark or others. But how would you define the business model? And is the key component when the lessor mitigates the residual risk, is that the key component? Or is it that they are regulated as a financial institution? They are providing a form of financing. What would you say if we went down a business model route?
Well, I think it's easier to define the business model that Brian just talked about. It's companies where their stock and trade is the equipment. They buy equipment on spec, and a piece of equipment, depending upon the kind of equipment, maybe in a truck, it's not leased all that many times, but a 50-year life rail car could get leased 10 times to 10 different lessees. That one, I think, is a lot easier. The financial model, the way I describe it, is like bank regulations, where the customer orders the equipment and you just assess a residual, you give them some pricing with a residual risk that you don't intend to have that asset on your books if the lessee returns that asset. Your residual is priced, assuming you're going to sell it to a dealer or you're going to sell it on auction. Only rarely would you be releasing that equipment, and mostly it's to work something out, you know, to try to recover the asset. If a second rental gets you more than what you could auction it off for, you'll do that. But my former employer was Citibank. We didn't want airplanes and vessels and PCs on our books, and we didn't have any means of disposing of those assets other than through auctions or, like I said, sale through a dealer. So
John,
that's a little – the finance model is a little bit harder.
Do you have a direct response to Russ? Yeah.
Okay. The challenge will be sometimes that, you know, within a diverse organization, you may have components that are more in a, well, called more of a bank finance company mode, and others that are, you know, buying assets speculatively, putting them on lease multiple times. And then occasionally, sometimes even within the own business, you could have two different models going on, you know, side by side. So then it's a question of how does one, you can define business model various ways, but you may have to go down even lower than a reporting segment or reporting unit to get to that level.
Mark?
Sure. We are, I think, as everyone recognizes, a financing company. So this is really an interesting question because, you know, what Bill had presented was that a financing company, well, we want financing treatment, therefore we buy residual guarantee insurance to make sure that we get that. We don't do that. We have operating leases on our balance sheet today. We have cars on our balance sheet, which, as Bill aptly pointed out, when they come back to us, we have no intent on holding them. We will absolutely sell them. But that risk is part and parcel and the component of today's accounting, and we've accepted that. Now, I will say that from an alternative perspective, our first alternative, and I think we provided two in our comment letter, our first alternative is very close to this model. It's, you know, let's assume financing arrangements as akin to a financing lease today. Let's look at them from that perspective and let's go down that route. We would certainly be more accepting of that than going down the residual and receivable approach. Again, more for the cost-benefit perspective than anything because, again, we don't think there's significant benefit, while we do think there's significant cost in terms of recognizing the residual and receivable approach.
George?
Thanks, Sue. I got to shift the real estate a little bit here, and I do have to say that if the board's decided not to change lessor accounting, we'd be happy. We're also happy with the response that the boards have provided to lots and lots and lots of input that we've provided you both in the U.S. and globally. We've had investors and analysts talk to you, submit comment letters, and the thing they focus on is very simple. The way they evaluate the investment quality of a real estate company, like a REIT or other publicly held real estate company, is to understand the revenue stream, the total revenue stream, the net operating income, and the value of the total property. And they've said as early as, I think it was August 2010, we had a meeting in London. We had six investors there from North America and Europe, and they were very, very clear. They need to see the full income, the full rental income stream, and they need to see the full property. And at that time, they were saying, don't take the receivable out of the property because that's where the value comes from, the lease stream. So we actually want to acknowledge the boards for hearing the real estate investors and analysts and actually proposing a model, the Type B model, that would provide that information that, again, our analysts and investors say is what they need to evaluate the investment quality of a real estate company. So we do want to mention that some of the board's constituents may suggest a single model. We, of course, would not object to that model. In fact, would fully support it as long as it looked like the Type B model. I just want to mention that we've done a lot of work with the receivable and residual approach. Back in the summer of 2011, we actually modeled a four-story office building with seven tenants and turnover and how you would apply the receivable and residual model to that simple investment property. Believe me, it doesn't work. It's not operational, and it doesn't provide the information that the investors and analysts need. So, again, thank you for listening to this industry over the last 6 years, and don't give us a Type A model for real estate. Thank you.
James, and then we'll turn to measurement.
Okay, real quick. all right, George, I'm going to echo what you said again. I am going to add a few things to that, though. We did have a discussion on business model. The whole idea of the business model was brought up under a different context about a year ago with investment companies, investment property entities. It's a tough nut to crack. even within our industry, we had approached the board with a business model approach to some of those accounting standards, too, and we were unable to come to terms. If maybe we spent the time and we approached a business model solution to many of the standards, that would probably work if we can get there, and we wouldn't be in a disagreement to that type of an approach. I will say from, and again, this, I guess real estate always goes last here. That's okay. Fair market value even more last. But from our perspective, we agree with the Type B. This is where I'm going to echo George's comments. The Type B approach is very accommodating for us. It really achieves what we've achieved over the last several years. The one element that I would say is from the fair value standpoint, is that the straight line, a straight lining of rent does not really work for us. I know the standard says straight lining or other systematic approach that is good. I would hope that you could either provide an exemption for those fair value reporters or provide some clarification that the straight lining of rent is simply not part of a fair value model. I know in Europe, under IFRS rules, that they continue to straight line the rent, and I can tell you they continue to remove it as an element of reporting to investors because it does not provide value to our investor group. And I can only speak from the real estate side there. So,
sure.
Sorry, I just wanted to ask Mark one question, just to clarify your thoughts, Mark, because I think you said you would describe yourself, if we're talking about business model, as being more a financing lessor in a sense. But I know you're saying you had some issues potentially with receivable and residual. Is it more around the difference, the changes between how receivable and residual works compared to, say, sales type accounting? So the fact that there is a kind of unearned profit element to do with the residual, the fact that residual value guarantees are not considered to be, you know, sort of part of the receivable?
Yeah.
I just wanted to understand your thoughts.
Well, it's just in terms of the system that we have, it's a proprietary system. It's house built or home built. It's built on the FAS 13 model. So under the FAS 13 model, we have the financing, the capability to do financing leases. We don't have the capability to pull together the residual and the receivable without significant rework to that system.
Yeah, so I think I understand. So you're saying it's just the further that model moves away from the existing kind of, I call it finance lease accounting or financing accounting, the more change would need to happen and the more cost.
Correct.
That you would. Thank you.
Scott, you want to kick off our discussion on measurement?
Sure. For the next half hour or so, we'd like to talk about the measurement provisions of the revised ED. Now, effectively, there are two components we'd like to cover in this section. The first is how do certain items affect the initial measurement of the lease asset and liability, and then let's also discuss the reassessment provisions, whereby in certain cases, if there are changes in relevant factors or changes in index or rates, you will reassess the lease liability and the lease asset during the lease term. Now, as a refresher, the revised ED states that with respect to the lease term is only the non-cancelable period of the lease contract, plus any optional periods for which there is a significant economic incentive to exercise that renewal. Variable lease payments are excluded from the measurement of the lease liability, except to the extent that they are in substance fixed payments or based on an observable index or rate, such as a market interest rate or a consumer price index, etc. The discount rate is the rate that the lessor charges the lessee on the lessor side, with an accommodation on the lessee side being that if that is not readily determinable, then the lessee will use its incremental borrowing rate. Now, again, reassessment of those items will occur when there are change in relevant factors that would affect the lease term, such as the lessee's significant economic incentive to exercise a renewal, and it is reassessed each time the index or rate changes on variable lease payments that are based on an index or a rate. So with that, we'll open it up to discuss those aspects of the revised ED.
John?
With regards to lease term, what I would say is that I understand the board's intent. First, should point out that I think that pulling the definition of lease term back toward existing GAAP, I think, was a positive development in the project. What my suggestion would be, though, if the intent is truly to pull the definition back to what exists in GAAP today, I think using as many words that exist today as possible to achieve that is best, because otherwise there will be significant effort involved in interpreting the new words. So as we move from I'll call under U.S. GAAP a penalty-based approach that existed in FAS 98 to a significant economic incentive approach, there's going to be effort, there's going to be some uncertainty on the transition, and I would urge you to, if your intent is truly to keep things the same, then keep them the same.
Others want to comment on initial measurement? John Bishop?
Thanks, Sue. I echo John's comment on if the intent around lease term is to, you know, keep things pretty much the same, then don't unnecessarily create confusion and keep the words the same. We do note that the indicators do look very familiar to us, so, you know, let's just stick with the concept of reasonable assurance and the penalty-based approach. The migration from a sort of a set it and forget it kind of model that we have today to a reassessment of term, we think at the margin is positive, and so we're supportive of that part of the proposal. One part of the proposal that we struggle with is how lessees, measure the variety of residual value guarantees together with purchase options, where at the end of the day the substance is the lessee will be paying the fixed amount. You know, we have structures in the marketplace that go by the nomenclature synthetic leases, and those are the ones in which, through the magic of Statement 13, we get operating lease treatment, but the tax authorities see it for what it is, and it's essentially a transfer of the risk and rewards to the lessee. You know, today's accounting is just the interest element of those leases show up as operating lease expense, and the capital recovery element is not part of it. You know, all the effort to put leases on the balance sheet, we're going to miss that key part if we don't focus on a lessee's measurement of its obligation when they have an option to buy and a residual value guarantee at the same price.
Jim?
On lease term and sort of the desire to keep things as close to similar as we can, do you have a view on whether practice between U.S. GAAP and IFRS treat reasonably assured and the threshold of reasonably certain as the same? And if not, would there be a desire to at least converge, so pick one, and then suggest if practice isn't converged, how that one might converge that practice without changing the words?
I'm not an IFRS practitioner, Jim, but on the U.S. side, you know, I think candidly the concepts around reasonable assurance, whether an option is exercisable or a renewal is exercisable, could be tightened up a little bit. And my little bit of knowledge on the IAS 17 side, and they have that additional test as to whether the property is unique for the purpose and so on and so forth, that I think would be helpful in the U.S. market, because we don't have the ability to look at that kind of indicator. So I think the concepts could be tightened up around, you know, short-term leases where you know the property is important to the lessee, and the likelihood is that they're going to renew, but there really isn't any an objective indicator to force them to include it. I think that could be tightened up.
Monty?
I'm really just echoing the comments about the definition of the term. It's probably our number one concern on the entire project is how the economic incentive could get interpreted different ways. We might have cases where there's a bargain type option, but because of a business change, we wouldn't want to take advantage of it. So, again, if the intent is to leave it the same, then just like the others have said, we would recommend leaving the language close to the way it is. That's it.
John?
We also are happy with the current construct of an economic penalty. One thing maybe a little different is that we see the existence of options to renew as being a potential indicator of control of the underlying asset by the lessee or a transfer of control by the lessor. And if you were to examine a control-based model, that would be another factor to be involved.
Bill? Can you turn your mic on?
Sorry. I commend the board for listening to all of the feedback and making the changes to the lease term. Repeating myself, I do think that if the intent is to keep it the same, we should keep it the same. One of the things with reassessment, I also think that that makes a lot of sense, but coupling reassessment with the complicated Type B accounting is a big problem, and going back to the simplification, I think we need a much simpler Type B accounting to deal with reassessment. And then in looking ahead at some of the questions on – okay, yeah, I think that's it. I'm skipping ahead of myself.
Okay. Brian?
Just conceptually, I have a hard time getting around how an economic incentive to renew creates a liability at measurement, a lease liability especially. I just have concern when you could have two identical contracts, and because one lessee installs an expensive piece of equipment in there, they're going to have a totally different asset and liability recognized. Also think there's a lot of subjectivity in that. It'd be difficult to audit, especially. And then also on the reassessment side, I think the variable rate tied to CPI is adds unnecessary complexity. I think all variable lease payments if they were simply disclosed, could provide enough information for investors. I'm thinking similar to like interest rate risk. If X rate increases so much percent, this is how it would affect our expense.
Do others share Brian's views on variable lease payments? Or want to comment? Bill?
I do think, looking back at my Excel model for accounting for an executory lease, if the rate changes, let's say it's a floating rate lease, I'll change my discount rate and I'll change my future payments and the PV is the same. If CPI changes, I'll change the future payments for the new CPI and I'll discount it back. I'll still be able to get my new PV and I won't have to go through the complicated debits and credits that the Type B accounting forces us into. So I think I do think that the boards came to the right answer on variable lease payments, but coupling that with Type B accounting and the complexity, I think it's more in real estate leases than most equipment leases, that we're almost, I think almost all real estate leases have CPI built into it, but whereas many equipment leases don't. Truck leasing may be an exception, but all of the leases that my company did had no CPI clauses in it. So I think it's I think that the root cause of many of our complexities is in the idea that even though we say that there's no financing element in Type B, we impute some interest, and that just creates tremendous complexity.
John?
I think with regards to changes in floating rate leases, Bill is correct that in most cases maybe the asset and liability will equal. However, if you have a spread change, there could be a little bit of a difference. And I guess my question is that little bit of a difference enough to require a recalculation, at least from a cost-benefit perspective? It seems like a lot of effort for not much gain either on the lessor or lessee side.
John?
I would like to note that not all variable payments are created equal. Some of them may actually relate to some of the service elements of the contract or could be allocated reasonably to the service elements of a contract, and I think that is a provision that should be included if you're going to go forward with this, and therefore they wouldn't involve a reconsideration or a reassessment of the asset and liability. So this is anything based on usage, perhaps it may be attributable to either to maintenance, wear and tear, or common area maintenance, even things of that nature. A lot of times common area maintenance is baked in at the there's a starting level included in the lease payments, and then any increases are attributed going forward. I think that's that too. There should be an option, just like in revenue recognition, to allocate the variable costs to the service elements and not consider them as part of the asset obligation.
Other comments? Okay. I think we're about 5 minutes late for our break. So if we could take a 15-minute break, we'll come back at 11:05. Okay, we're going to get started. The next topic that we want to discuss is, can we quiet down? The next topic that we'd like to discuss is a scope, and Lisa will kick us off on that topic.
Thanks, Sue. So under scope, we have two main points that we'd like to discuss. That would be the definition of a lease and separating components. For definition of a lease in the ED, a lease is defined as a contract that conveys the right to use an asset, the underlying asset, for a period of time in exchange for consideration. And underneath this, to have a lease, you would have to have an identified asset, either explicitly or implicitly identified. And it would have to convey the right to control based on an ability to direct the use and to receive the economic benefits. As far as separating components, you would separate if the lessee is able to obtain a standalone observable price or obtain that price. With that, if you turn to questions 9 through 11, you'll see 9 relates to the definition, 10 relates to the separation, and 11 is asking if you have any suggestions beyond your concerns.
So we did touch on some of this a little bit earlier, but if we could expand a bit more. Does anybody want to kick off our discussion? Thanks, Tom.
As I've gone to great lengths to mention, full-service truck leasing has a very significant service component. We're concerned about unbundling and the fact that we would have to certainly share much more information than we do now with the lessee, and a lot of that information, very proprietary information, that we would both be sharing with the lessee and then potentially with our other lessor competitors through the unbundling process. One of the things that we've suggested in our comment letter is perhaps rather than specifically separating out or unbundling the service component from the asset component in a specific lease, that there be some sort of process using observations in the market to create an estimate or a benchmark by which the lessee can estimate those costs without us having to reveal proprietary information. That would be our comments on unbundling.
Mark?
Yeah, I think we only had one minor comment in this area, and it was all in the Q&A of our comment letter. But the general thought that we have with respect to, you know, determining whether it's a volume-based contract or whether it's an asset-based contract. I think in your example, you use a pipeline. In our example, we use server space. So I'm a little concerned that, you know, if we were to lease server space, and I'm speaking purely from a lessee perspective at this point, if we were to lease server space from someone who has 10 servers and we're just getting a certain amount of space, and our lease price goes up based on the amount of usage, that seems like it's a usage contract and would not fall under the lease guidance. However, on the flip side, if we're leasing the equivalent of one server space, but it could be on any of 10 or 20 servers, if we can identify it as being on one server, then I think it does end up being under the lease guidance. And I'm not sure if that's the right place to draw the line. I don't know that I have an alternative answer, but it's a concern that we have.
Okay. Katrina?
Sorry, I was just going to add a comment to that. I suppose that the example you've just given, and sorry, this is my personal view, I should say, the example you've just given is one area perhaps where I would view a difference between the answer you might get to today under 018 or IFRIC 4 in terms of determining that there would be a lease versus going forward, where in my personal view you're more likely to get to a service answer in the very brief fact pattern you described. So I only wanted to say that your specific example is one area that I thought we were now addressing in the changes made to the definition of a lease.
Phil?
Just one item. I mentioned it before about the NA committee feels very strongly about that there should be some sort of de minimis amount Again, as I mentioned before earlier, there was a comment letter that suggested the amount of any asset, any lease total that comes to less than $250,000 to exclude, to scope that out. One of the things that we're concerned about, there is a, the PPC has put out an exemption, put out a proposal to exempt VIEs from quoting for non-public companies. One of the things, we've not commented on that yet, but the committee has a concern about if we have leases, how is that going to reconcile with the PCC exemption for exempting them from the VIE treatment. We're not quite seeing how that we unwind the lease in one, and we unline that in one case, and then we put it back, and the leases go in place. Now, this is all based upon the lease proposal as presently constituted. I don't know whether the PCC would exempt private companies from this definition on the leases. That'd be up to them and for them to make that decision.
Russ,
just on that note, I mean, there is specific differences for non-public and public. One of the most important is focusing on the related party leases. So in those cases, in the VIE, those are related party leases, and you account for the pure form, not the substance of the related party lease. So the fundamental difference in that is you'd have to put the entire real estate, the entire debt on the books. What this would do is you'd only put the lease, the actual contract between the manufacturing or the office and the office building. So it's much shorter than the actual entire amount.
Jim?
Just so I understand the proposal on de minimis, you're not talking about really a de minimis threshold per se, but literally a fixed dollar amount of something like $250,000. So
yeah,
that if an entity had $1 million balance sheet, it could be, a quarter of its balance sheet, or if it had a trillion dollar balance sheet. And obviously private companies range anywhere in between, or are you talking something that's scalable?
Well, one of the things that would come into play is there'd actually be some sort of capitalization rules. Now, if you're, I'll give you the example. My landlord is Harvard University. Their capitalization limit is $100,000 or greater than $100,000 they capitalize. Below that, they expense in terms of the capitalization rules. But my small clients, the capitalization rule may be $1,000. So I think what needs to be done is there needs to be some sort of number. 250 is the number I read in one of the comment letters. I don't disagree with that. That if the asset comes, if the total asset, total lease obligations, come less than 250, then that be scoped out of the proposal.
Do you think that the users of a private company's financial statements, they do not think that the amounts that we're talking about are liabilities or have cash flow?
I don't think that the users of the financial statements of which, for private companies, would find the information useful if it was on the balance sheet. I believe that they would go with what's on the disclosure. I don't think that it's information that would be particularly valuable either to evaluating the company or determine or analyzing the company.
So I understood your example of capitalization thresholds. A lot of companies have them. They're usually scalable. There isn't one number. In fact, there's not even guidance in GAAP on capitalization thresholds, but I think it's pretty reasonable practice. But I think it would be maybe a different thing if we were rethinking GAAP to say every company has a threshold of $250,000. That might actually create a little bit of controversy because for some companies that might make perfect sense, and others it might not make any sense. I'm just wondering why it would be sort of a single bright line here, but
The only thing I'm trying to say is there should be some sort of scoping out for small and medium entities in terms of, because again, the information that we're going to put on the balance sheet is just not that valuable. So there should be some sort of scoping out. Now, I know there's in some areas there's a $10 million asset test in some under GAAP, under some parts of GAAP. Maybe that could be applied. I'm saying, 250 is a number that, I've seen in one of the comment letters, in terms of expressing what that number would be.
Okay, I have a couple double hands going up. I got Daryl and Russ and Gary.
Just one more comment on capitalization thresholds to be clear, because I've seen this comment in several comment letters. Currently capitalization thresholds with regard to PP&E are not part of GAAP. You know, that's a decision that's been made by the entity based on materiality considerations. And so, you know, for those that have requested that the boards consider some sort of a capitalization threshold with regard to leases, I think that's going to be a stretch, you know, because that again, I think the boards would view that as a materiality decision, and that's not the sort of thing that we tend to promulgate through standards.
Russ?
Finally, your ask of having some scope out, is that only for things that are operating leases today or all leases? In other words, if it's a capital lease today and it's on balance sheet, are you asking that would also be scoped out and taken off balance sheet?
I would say just operating leases in the case. If it's still a finance lease, then that would still follow the standards.
Okay.
Carrie?
Actually, Jim was on my point about capitalization thresholds and the immateriality test. I would think to Phil, certainly some level, you don't have to apply the standards, the immaterial stuff would come into play. And I think what would be important to you, if I understand it, would be the $250,000 threshold might be material in some cases, and you'd be looking for that. Certainly the immaterial ones at that, you know, would already be presumably scoped out if the preparer chose to do so.
John? Oh, sorry, John Hepp. Just got to use the last names.
Yeah, it looks like I'm back in grade school.
We have a few issues with the scope. One of them was brought up here a minute ago. The changes in IT are bringing up some issues that are still evolving at this time, and I'm not sure this proposal will address those very well. And also with the issue of the software, the intangible assets, I believe, are scoped out by the FASB, and the ISB, you have an option to include it. This is one of the unconverged differences, I think, between the FASB and the ISB proposal. We'd certainly rather see a converged answer in that regard, if we could. So that's I think, an important scope issue as well. We raised another one, too, about many leases are, if you accounted for them as a purchase, would actually be a business combination. This gets into the issue of, say, the power plants, for example, that we see dedicated power plants that would often meet the definition of a business, and accounting for that as a right-of-use asset would give you a very different accounting answer than if you accounted for it as a business combination, for example. And we see leases of hospitals, ski resorts, you know, everything right down to the Band-Aids or the ski poles type of thing, and I don't know if even this model works well for any of those situations when you get right down to it. If you would consolidate the entity that they're in, then I would think you should consolidate it. If you wouldn't consolidate it because you don't control it, I think you would be back to the contract as the unit of account, not the the assets. The unit of account, we think, changes depending on what type of lease you have, whether it's the underlying asset or the contract. And this scope issue that we have here, and this is probably our biggest issue that we have, is focused entirely on the underlying asset. And we think that times that a lease, we may want to be accounting for the whole contract in that regard. Can you give me an example of it's really a business combination? You use hospitals and ski resorts. Like, what? Just give me a – well, we can do it offline, too, but are they – 40-year, 50-year leases? What are they?
Well, sometimes I've seen a 5-year lease for a hospital where there might be a purchase option at the end at fair value, so that for 5 years you've got an operating lease on the part of the acquirer, and then you would go through business combination accounting supposedly at the time at the end of the fifth year. Some of the other arrangements that you'll see are quite long. They'll be 25-5.
But they wouldn't trip the consolidation rules under VIE, even VIE accounting?
We may not even look at them sometimes, but it depends on if it's been put into a special purpose entity or not.
But
who has the employees that runs the hospital? The less are they lessee's employees or the lessor's employees?
They become the lessee's employees at the time. Well,
so it's, again, so it's broader than just the underlying plan.
Yes. The power plant can be the same sort of issue, though. You know, it's
yeah. Yeah. Okay.
Brian.
Just a few comments on scope. I like the 12-month carve-out. I think there was somebody mentioned a possible 36-month carve-out. I think if that happened, though, that would likely drive economic behavior. I think the 12-month is good. I don't think it's going to encourage anybody to rent versus a long-term lease. But I think if you extend that, that'll certainly drive people to look more at the short-term option. I don't know if we've ever had a good definition of executory costs, insurance, taxes, but I noticed even EY in their technical lines that it was unclear how that would be considered under the proposal, if it'd be a lease component or non-lease component, and then how you would actually separate those. And again, going back to the observable standalone prices, I would encourage lessees to use more judgment instead of being required to have stated quotes.
Stacy?
Thank you. As I go around the country trying to teach CPAs this new standard, we've come across an issue where we believe there might be another gray area under the proposal, and that is in regards to that the terminology for a contract right now calls for enforceable rights and obligations, and in particular when we're talking about related party leases, fairly common that they're undocumented, fairly common that they are non-arm's length terms and conditions. So, therefore, if they fail to create these enforceable rights and obligations, are they scoped out? And if they're scoped out, how would we, you know, we can assume that we would continue with current GAAP, but that's just not addressed anywhere in the exposure draft right now.
So the question is if they do trip, because we have some reliefs in the proposal now for related party leasing. So the question is, what did they do if you fall into that category?
If you're theoretically scoped out because you don't create those, you know, that's always the gray area, the enforceable rights and obligations. So, therefore, are they scoped out? Would those types of undocumented or non-arm's length transactions be scoped out as it exists right now?
Okay. I think we have guidance in the proposal on that.
Does it specifically address the non-enforceable rights and obligations? Because we didn't interpret it that way.
I'll just clarify that what we've got is that we define a lease as a contract, that blah, 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 where you transfer the right of use, and then we define a contract as an agreement between two or more parties that creates enforceable rights and obligations. So at least the moment we are saying a contract needs to have enforceable rights and obligations, and a lease is a contract.
And I guess that's where the gray area that has been identified. And, you know, this is coming from a lot of constituents that we speak to, is the gray areas. If, how do we say, you know, when things are undocumented or they're not done, they have specific terms that are obviously related party terms. How do we identify that it creates these enforceable rights? That it's the wording that could change our perception.
Oh, is what you're saying is that you actually, because I think what we have in the ED is in a related party, you account for the contract.
Right.
What you're saying is the mere fact that it's a related party may call into question whether it's an enforceable right.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I think she's saying if it fails the definition of a lease,
mm-hmm.
because it doesn't have enforceable rights, then does it still, do you apply the form over substance guidance on the related party, right?
Okay.
Including how do you identify what the contract is when there's no
right.
sort of contract.
Right, when there's no sort of contract. That's the thing. It's the sort of gray area that people can't get their head around.
Yeah, on that part, I thought we said it's only the contract. It's not what's not there. But I think you're raising a different point another point that says even when you have a contract, mm-hmm. it may not be enforceable.
Right.
And I didn't think about that one.
Okay, I have Bill Bosco.
Yeah. in terms of scope, one way to simplify the standard is to scope out those transactions that are in substance purchases. I know we're kind of late in the game for that, but then you'd have the unit of account would be the underlying, and all the other leases would be right of use leases where the contract would be the appropriate unit of account, in my opinion. In terms of materiality and an attempt to scope things out, I just wanted to put things into perspective. If we had a materiality allowed operating lease treatment for all leases where the asset cost was $250,000 or less, or the lease term was 5 years or less, you'd probably scope out 95% of the equipment leases. Because the way the basis for the equipment leasing market, except for long-term assets, it's they call it like a bank market product, where ultimately leasing companies are financed in the bank market, and they generally don't like to go out beyond 5 years. So if you set, even if you just had a five-year term, you'd be scoping out most of, except for trains and boats and planes in equipment leasing, you'd be scoping everything else out, like office equipment, IT equipment, phone systems, medical equipment, cars, trucks, construction equipment, material handling. So if instead of looking at $250,000, if you looked at a term and said it was 5 years, you'd get rid of a lot of the complexity for small and medium-sized enterprises. You know, most small and medium-sized enterprises, regardless of whether the lease accounting is complex or not, they're going to lease because they don't have access to public markets. They borrow from their banks, and they borrow or they finance anything that they can, and so they're going to continue to lease. It's the nature of the beast. It's either the owner's equity or their line bank that finances the company, so they'll lease anything else that they can. So I don't think even if we say let's set the term at 3 years, as Brian was saying, well, leases would go to 3 years. Well, not the company I used to work for, because the shorter the term, the higher the residual risk. We just wouldn't even do that deal. So saying that the market would just go to a two-year truck lease or a three-year truck lease, maybe from Ryder, but not from Bank of America, or my old company was Citibank. They don't do leasing anymore. But, you know, it is a risky transaction, and the longer the term, the more the asset amortizes, the greater the likelihood that a financial institution would do that kind of a lease. So I just wanted to put that into perspective, that if you selected 5 years as a term, not an asset size, you'd be eliminating about 95% of equipment leases. But you'd probably still have 80 to 90% of the assets captured on balance sheet, because real estate would still be capitalized, and so would the trains and boats and planes.
John Bober.
You know, quick comment. You know, when echoing Philip's question, though, on capitalization policies, you know, one of the things to think about is how does one apply capitalization policies in the context of something where you're paying, you know, in annual installments, let's say, versus paying up front in cash. What does capitalization policy mean? Do I expense the asset and record a liability, or do I maintain operating lease accounting if I apply that here? That is something that perhaps more guidance could be appreciated.
Okay. Others? Mark?
If I can just make one point on Bill's comment. He brought up the concept of unit of account, and he suggested that in certain cases, for operating-type leases or equipment-type leases, I don't want to put words in your mouth, Bill, so clarify if I mess this up, but for all intent and purposes, the unit of account would be the contract level. Again, from a lessor perspective, you know, and thinking about things like PCs, I mean, we lease 500, 1,000 PCs at a time, and I'm not sure it's clear in the guidance. I think the unit of account is the individual PC. I think the contract might make more sense.
Tom?
I just want to speak to that unit of account being the contract. Very much so in truck leasing. In truck leasing, there's a contract with the lessee to provide them the right of use of really a vehicle. In many cases, the truck that the lessee starts the lease term with is not the same actual vehicle that they end the lease term with. So, in addition to the services, the maintenance services, the tax compliance services that the lessor provides, we are really providing that right to use pursuant to a contractual agreement that may not necessarily even be tied to one specific vehicle or not. A lot of times halfway through the lease, they'll rotate that vehicle out, give the lessee a new vehicle, and put the old vehicle, you know, to another use through another lease or through another into the rental fleet.
Any other comments on scope? John?
Just a couple of comments from our response letter and then a reaction to something that I heard. At a principal level, the scope language reads very very eloquently, and I know we're part of that. We're targeting some remediation to 018. But what we have found is some confusion among our client base on how to operationalize the concept of control, in particular in circumstances where big ticket items are being operated by the owner of the item on behalf of the lessee. So, you know, certainly the power plant with the power purchase arrangement, those are the obvious ones, but shipping arrangements, drill rigs, we've had points of view coming out of our practice that are different. And there are those that believe, based on the words and the examples, that you know, a ship charter arrangement would not be a lease. So there appears to be some confusion around how the examples try to operationalize the principle, and we're concerned about operationality. We're concerned about substitution, the way the standard focuses or does not focus on the impediments to substitution, and in particular circumstances where the asset resides on the lessee's premises. We think the words are not clear enough that it would be very unusual for that not to be a lease, whereas we're seeing the words potentially supporting that not being a lease because of the right for the lessor to go in there and swap out the property and put new equipment in. On the thing that I heard here on this five-year proposal, it's interesting. And it's interesting with your statistics, Bill, that it would capture, you know, a large portion of the equipment leasing population. I guess my reaction is I question whether that conceptually would be an improvement from where we are. I mean, where we are now, at least we have a model that attempts to look at the commercial substance of an arrangement, and if it doesn't meet the threshold for finance purchase, we say it's an executory contract. I question whether a blanket five-year line in the sand is moving the bar in terms of an improvement in financial reporting. You know, if we're going to go that route, then let's stick with operating leases that we have today.
I agree with that, and I think the five-year threshold or any threshold is more of a response to the proposal as a way to perhaps improve the proposal than an improvement over what we have today. So I echo that.
Mark?
Just help me out a little more on the substitution rights, because I'm struggling with trying to think through this too, and I've been for a while. Because Tom was going through an example where it sounded like, you know, you had a truck that you would substitute halfway through the lease term. And you said you still thought that would fall into the definition of a lease. And I guess, you know, we talk about if you have substantive substitution rights, then maybe it's not a lease. John, you suggested that if the underlying equipment resides at the customer, maybe substitution rights shouldn't matter as much. Maybe focusing just solely on substitution rights shouldn't matter as much.
We're thinking that when in those circumstances where the equipment resides at the customer's premises, more often than not, what substitution rights are warranty provisions. If the particular equipment's not going to be working, then the lessor will act and swap it out.
So, like a copier machine.
Right, but barring that kind of circumstance, there's no commercial incentive to swap out the equipment that's in place.
And that's the same with truck leases as well. Brian, you can maybe speak better than I can to it, but you know, substitution wouldn't be made in case of during a repair, during a replacement, or if the vehicle's a lemon. Some of them are. You know, so the substitution would be made to ensure that the lessee's right to use is met pursuant to the contract, but I don't think the lessor substitutes for the lessor's own benefit in any way.
Daryl had the double hand.
If substantive substitution is allowed in these contracts, what's the point of even specifying the underlying asset in the first place?
It's not the intent to substitute at all. Again, I think truck leasing is at the far end of. We're talking about this broad spectrum of leasing, and I think truck leasing is at the very far end of the executory contract end of that spectrum. So the substitution again is there's not an intent to substitute. But there's a substitution in order to meet that lessee's right to use as spelled out in the contract.
I guess what I was getting at was if you believe that you're really providing a service and substitution of the underlying asset that's involved in that is allowed on a substantive basis, then why would you even specify the asset itself? But I think your response is telling me that you do think it's a lease. So...
Katrina?
Sorry, I just wanted to clarify with John if what you're saying is almost what you would think is to add a bit more clarity maybe about how we might think about the substantive substitution right notion working is if we clarified that or somehow added some words, because obviously our wording in there tries to get at when are they really substantive or not, and you know we try to imply we think they're not substantive if they really are kind of economic or operational barriers to the supplier going and changing. And I think what you're saying is, from your experience, you think it would add some clarity to that if we added in some words that implied, like, when the asset is kind of within the customer's control because it's on their premises, that kind of leads you down the direction of saying it doesn't sound like they're particularly
substantive.
That's what
we suggested in our comment letter.
Okay,
Katrina.
Thank you.
James?
You're looking to get into topic four, I can tell.
That's
here,
okay.
But and maybe this will do it. I did want to bring up something related to what Bill brought up and John talked about with the term. From a real estate standpoint, I don't think it quite matches up that way where 3 to 5 year makes sense. On the equipment side, maybe that makes sense from both the lessee and the lessor standpoint, but we butt heads in the real estate industry, where a lessee who might be incentive to keep a shorter term lease in place because he falls under the scope of complicated accounting doesn't match with the incentive of the lessor to create longer term leases and get people locked into buildings, something that demonstrates a better stability in your cash flow stream that's good for lenders, it's good for your investors. So that symmetry is not there. I can't say you put a five-year rule in for one side and not the other, that's something that would need to be worked out. But I did want to at least voice that side of things.
Any other comments, Bill?
Yeah, I think to talk about what John just said and what Jim just said, I just wanted to give the board a little bit of perspective to try to help small and medium-sized enterprises out with the kind of the lay of the land for the equipment leasing industry, that 95% of the numbers are in small pieces of equipment with terms that are up to 5 years. And it's really just to help the board out and trying to think, could I simplify it in some way? And I also wanted to make the point that shortening of the term, at least in equipment leasing, there's tremendous residual risk the shorter the term, and so people just are not going to just willy-nilly shorten leases.
Okay. Let's move on to the next topic. That's topic four. The questions are on page 7 of your materials. I really like to think about this as the catch-all topic. We can cover anything that you feel we have not covered thus far this morning that you'd like to comment to the boards on. That could be disclosure, could be transition, could be effective date, how long you need to prepare to implement the standard. As well as we've touched on already some concerns around non-public entities, but that certainly we can talk a little bit more about that. Bill?
Bring up the issue of I'd like to bring up the issue of sale-leaseback accounting. The way sale-leaseback accounting is proposed, the presence of a purchase option at any amount less than the sales price negates sale treatment. And sale-leasebacks are very common in equipment leasing, and that would present a burden not only in just – well, it would present a burden in transition because I think every lease has to be looked at to see if it's a sale-leaseback at the equipment level. So I think that should – as a transition simplification, I think we should – you should consider not doing that. But I think in my mind the control concept is similar to risks and rewards or similar to what I've been talking about in terms of risks and rewards. The control concept in a sale leaseback, saying that the seller lessee still has control and therefore still has the asset on its books, legally it doesn't. And so that's another break between the alignment between legal tax and accounting. And then I also step back and I say, well, if I just leased a piece of equipment and had a purchase option in it, it's a lease. But if I and I capitalize the present value of the minimum lease payments. But if I momentarily got into the chain of ownership, it now becomes a sale leaseback, and the same terms are accounted for completely differently. When in substance, I'm in the same position. Do I control, as a lessee in a new equipment lease, do I control that asset because I have a purchase option at less than the fair value initially? Yet if I did a sale leaseback, I do have control. And that's kind of the theoretical look. But the practical look is that, you know, the way my company would operate, we'd have a master lease line with lessees, and they'd fund the equipment, and once a month we'd do a sale leaseback. Almost every corporate jet that's leased, the lessee orders the corporate jet, probably has to put some kind of deposit down. Boom, they're in the chain of ownership. Now it's a sale leaseback. So it's like I said, it's very common in just the daily operation of small ticket equipment leases. And even bigger ones like corporate jets, that those sale leasebacks may not be accounted for as leases. Yet, if it was, like I said, just a new lease, it would be accounted for as a lease.
Other comments, Phil?
Yeah, just I have a few comments on the transition. First off, this is going to take a massive educational program. Everybody in this room is well aware of this, but there are many small practitioners who have no idea this is even out there in the world at this point. Stacy probably could address better what kind of educational process may be needed to get this up to date. I also would ask, and probably the board will do this anyway, is that there be a later effective date for non-public companies. With respect to the gentlemen who are here from the big firms, many of us in the small firms actually look and see what they've done and kind of let them be the educators of us, too, and see how they've treated it. And I thank them for their work on this at times. It does help us to see how to apply these, how to write the footnotes, and how to put the financial statements together. So the board will probably do that, but I do want to mention that to them.
John? Or Bill? Sorry.
About that. I think in transition, lessors are required to look at the current fair value of the asset, I think really they should look at the original residual and look at the original assumptions in transitions rather than having to go through and try to find a fair value for a used piece of equipment. It's going to be a tremendous burden. Especially if you have to do it on an asset-by-asset basis. So that's an issue. The other fix that you know, if we talk about looking at IAS 17 as the basis for lease classification, regardless of the asset type, you get away from the complicated transition for Type A leases because that complicated transition was designed to kind of eliminate the hit to P&L rather to put that hit into equity. Well, if you change the lease classification, it tremendously simplifies the transition for operating leases, for the equipment leases that are type A leases that really, in my opinion, are executory contracts. That's it. Thanks.
Mark?
Yeah, Bill actually did kind of hit on the point I was going to make with respect to transition, particularly around the modified retrospective approach. From a lessor perspective, we have 700,000 leased assets, as I indicated earlier. For us to come up with a fair value at transition of 700,000 cars is going to be monumental. We've suggested a practical expedient for transition of utilizing the current carrying value of the assets on our books. So there'd be no day one, you know, P&L impact or cum catch, if you will, in terms of the valuation. We would just break the asset apart as it sits today into its residual and receivable components and move on from there.
George.
Under the umbrella of what the board might be able to do to simplify the proposal, I talked before about the accounting for tenant reimbursables by the landlord. These are reimbursables of tenants, of landlord cost to maintain landlord property. It would be great if and this is very controversial and very debatable throughout the real estate industry globally and in the U.S. The firms, preparers, et cetera. If the boards could provide an example showing these costs and how they are counted for as lease income, it would really be helpful. It would eliminate this controversy.
John Bober.
You know, as you think about transition, it's very important to think about where you end up in the final proposals, because, for example, you know, right now the unit of account is the individual asset if you have an equipment lease. And if you have to load all those assets, put them all in, build in your systems for reassessments, et cetera, you start to have a very difficult thing to implement in total, and you need more time to prepare for it. So to the extent that, you know, things are made more difficult, you know, I would argue for more time, to the extent you simplify things, you can pull back an effective date. But as the boards have heard before, no one is going to really start programming systems to help lessees deal with this until there's a final standard. As a, you know, lessors will not deal with it to program their systems until they have a final standard. So you are talking about something that's, you know, not implementable for 3-4+ years, possibly.
John Hepp.
One of our general concerns in here is that lessor accounting be as consistent as possible with the revenue recognition standard. We wouldn't want to see opportunities to get a different accounting treatment depending on whether a very economically similar transaction was accounted for as a sale or a lease. And that would go into areas including measurement and covering when you would consider a transfer of control. For example, we think that equipment and real estate should probably have the same criteria between A and B, and it should be the higher end, not the lower end, because that would be more consistent with revenue recognition. For example, and that also applies to the transition, there's some transition provisions in revenue recognition that we think should be applied very similarly to lease transactions by the lessor.
Brian?
Not transition related, but the fair value discussion reminded me of this. I wasn't clear that there is a definition of fair value of leased asset in the new guidance. I know, especially for lessors, the current guidance says it is the price paid net of discounts, and I didn't clearly see that carry over to the new guidance. So that could have some very different impacts on our upfront profit recognition.
I think that's only on transition where the fair value comes in. I think you're right in terms of the guidance itself.
Bill?
I'd like to
I'd like to make two more comments. First, when writing my comment letter, I did some research, and I found that the American Accounting Association had made a or provided the board with comments to the first second G4 plus one paper, and they listed four characteristics of a conceptually sound leasing standard. Well, we've been talking about a lot of these things that they recommended in 2001. First of all, in item number one, they said the property under lease should not affect the accounting. Second thing they said is that leases are a special case of accounting for contracts. Third thing that they said that is that the approach should require that substantially similar contracts be accounted for similarly, but substantially dissimilar contracts should not be forced into a misleading appearance of comparability. And then the fourth characteristics of their recommendations of what should be in a standard is they did say that lease contracts are unique, and it's very difficult, if not infeasible, to identify similar lease contracts. And I think a lot of these words were written in 2001, and we're still dealing with these issues, but they appear to have been ignored for the most part in progressing with the ED. The last thing I'd like to mention is that I've talked a lot about the UCC and the tax rules and the accounting rules being aligned, and they're also aligned with IAS 17, at least in the U.S. environment. And I do realize that if we're attempting to converge, we have to deal with other places other than these great United States. There is a world out there. But I'm afraid that trying to fit leasing into a one lease solution may very well, it's like a lowest common denominator kind of a standard, and it just doesn't work in the U.S. So I'm saying that maybe it's not a convergence standard. Maybe the U.S. has to go their own way because leasing is so pervasive, and it affects so many things in our business environment and our UCC, our bankruptcy, our tax. I mean, just something as simple as doing a property tax return or providing information to a lender who's looking to see if they should lend the next dollar to your business, you have to use old GAAP. And that has to say something. We will continue to have to use existing GAAP to identify which assets am I responsible for paying property tax on, which assets am I responsible for paying sales tax up front or tax on the rent, which assets will my lender have the ability to access in a liquidation and which they won't. They all go back to FAS 13's four classification tests. So I'm saying that I think if the ED is written as it is, it'll be a tremendous complexity, burden, and a disservice to the U.S.
Stacy?
Yeah, my comments in regards to transition, it builds a little bit on that in regards to the thing we have to think about, and we talk about a lot, and I've heard practitioners talk about this, isn't just an accounting issue. So we need to deal with our debt covenants and things like that, which will automatically go into default. There's systems issues. And to talk about the complexity, although a lot of small, medium-sized entities understand leasing, a lot of them don't have capital leases, and they really only purely have operating leases. So the concept of present value can be a difficult concept to teach if they're not in it. So from a standpoint of it not being an accounting issue, there needs to be a significant amount of time, in particular for the smaller to medium-sized entities, to get on board. Just my comment.
Did you still want to get in? Okay. Larry?
So at the cost of potentially going over, a number of you have suggested that we just effectively retain 13 or 17 in terms of where the dividing line is. And if we were to consider that, there's a lot of noise out there about the significant cost, potential cost of implementing this standard. But if we were to change the dividing line, I'm interested in what the potential cost of implementation would be and how that might impact transition. Specifically, John, you mentioned that you might need 3 or 4 year lead time to implement what we've exposed. But if we drew that line back, you know, what kind of lead time would be necessary?
Yeah, I haven't given that significant thought at this point, but let's think of it this way. You know, right now you'd have to build out a classification system based on quantitative and qualitative factors. You already have a classification system. You would still need to program your systems to deal with the P&L patterns that you'd have here. I don't know. So that may argue for 3 years. To the extent you retain a unit of account at the individual asset, that might argue longer. To the extent that people can deal with similar assets on a more of a pool basis, that might argue for bringing it forward. That's a long-winded way of saying there's a lot of variables. I'm not quite sure.
John Bishop.
Yeah, just a quick reaction to your question, Larry. I think the classification question, in at least my reaction, that's more of a theoretical question. What should be the dividing line? Should there be a bias in the standard based on property type and so on? The area of implementation complexity, I think, comes from the fact that all leases, regardless of size, need to be capitalized. The Type B model is an oddball kind of income statement model, and that's going to be a struggle to put into systems, and the ongoing reassessment and remeasurement aspect of it is the part that I think is going to create the implementation challenges. So I wouldn't have thought that the classification moving the line would impact that, other than increase the number of Type Bs, which may make it more challenging to put into the systems.
John?
I mean, the only thing I would add, though, is that to the extent that you went towards sort of the display model that proposed in the FEI letter, that would be something that could be more readily implemented on an accelerated basis, because that information is essentially there. Yeah, as opposed to IAS 17 and everything that goes with that, that probably puts you more time. But a display model, hey, you have your expense by year, you can probably layer that in fairly quickly.
James?
I had some other thing, but I want to address that first. I agree with John. It depends on who you ask, right? Where are they right now? Where do they need to get? And I continually run into lessees who say, oh, they're changing the lease accounting rules. So if you're starting from, and I think Phil brought up the education issue, these people are starting from scratch in many cases and have no idea how to approach it, more or less assess where they stand as of now. So that time element is immeasurable for the group of people who haven't even touched it yet. I wanted to also add that from our perspective, our GAAP financial statements provide a lot of assurance for further measures that we do for the investment community, our performance measurement that we do currently based on contractual accrual-based income would change slightly if we were introducing straight-line rent and other features. That would change things. Someone mentioned earlier moving to non-GAAP financial statements, some other comprehensive basis or agreed-upon contractual basis. If we're straying in that direction, you're going to find a lot of people doing a lot less comparable things across the board. So if we can't find a solution within GAAP, we will destroy comparability across the board. I will also say, from a global standpoint, our organization promotes convergence. Investing in real estate is crossing borders rapidly. In the current environment, to find attractive yields in other marketplaces almost requires that you cross a border. So the convergence of the accounting standards would go great lengths to bring that industry, our industry, back in line. So we do have that comparability and that transparency across those borders. Enough said.
Brian?
Regarding costs, I think any change is going to have significant costs. Anytime you put on the balance sheet, you're probably going to need to have a separate lease accounting system. if you have more than probably 20 total leases as a company. So I don't think you're going to see a lot of cost savings if we retain today's classification, which so if we go to something that's similar to just having type B classification, you're going to have probably similar costs, but I think you're going to have a lot less resistance, and I think as long as you retain straight line expense recognition for today's operating leases, I think that makes more economic sense.
Okay. We've come to the end of our session. I wanted to thank everyone for participating today and for the thoughtful comments that you provided to us. Danielle, do you want to just give us a sense of next steps?
Sure. Thank you. So as most of you know, since the exposure draft came out in May, we have been performing outreach activities. We've been talking with investors and analysts. We've been meeting with different lessees and lessors. We've had the London roundtables. We had Brazil roundtables. We have one more this afternoon here. On October 3rd, we will be in L.A. There will be a morning session, and then the afternoon session will be focused more on the non-public entities. And then on the 4th of October, we have a Singapore roundtable. And I think to date we have about 579 comment letters, and I think some still coming in. So the staff plan to give the boards an update on all of our outreach activities, what we've heard from all the various roundtables, meetings, et cetera, and have kind of an outreach summary for the boards as well as a comment letter summary. And we're hoping to bring that to the boards in November of this year. And then we hope to begin deliberations shortly thereafter, either December or January timeframe. And then as far as effective date and all that and final issuance, obviously it depends how quickly we can get the re-deliberations completed and get some final standards in place. Hope, you know, the plan is to try to finalize in 2014, and we'll have to see how that goes.
Okay, with that, we'd like to thank everyone, and that concludes our roundtable. Thank you.